Om Parthaya Pratibodhi Tam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadvaishini. Okay. We're actually on verse 9, but we're going to every time chant from the Amani tone, okay? So,
you know the book either? It's in the car.
Om Amani Twamatam Bitwam. You want to do it together? That's fine, let's try. Om Om Amani Twamatam Bitwam. Ahimsa Kshantir Arjavam. Acharyo Pasanam Shaucham. Staryam Atma Vinigraha. Indriyarteshu Vairag. Repeat after me. Indriyarteshu Vairagyam. Indriyarteshu Vairagyam. Anahankara evacha. Anahankara evacha. Janma mrityu jara vyadhi. Janma mrityu jara vyadhi. Dukkha doshanu darshanam. Dukkha doshanu darshanam. Asaktirana bishwangaha. Asaktirana bishwangaha. Putradara grahadishu. Putradara grahadishu. Nityan chasamachittatvam. Nityam chasamachittatvam. Ishtanishto papattishu. Ishtanishto papattishu. So this is where we are. Asaktihi. Anabhishwangaha. Putra. Dara. Grahadishu. Graha. Adishu. Nityam cha. Samachittatvam. Ishta. Anishta, ishta, anishta, upapattishu, okay? So, asaktihi, sakti means attachment, to be attached to something. Asakti, that unnegates, right? So asakti is to be free from attachment or free from, Swamiji, when he's talking about freedom from ownership. Because it's freedom from ownership, freedom from attachment. The idea is that we all have lots of things, but there's a difference between having things that are in our possession and having ownership of things. Because in fact, everything that we have is with us only for a period of time. And that's just reality. You know, everything. Every single thing that you have, including your physical body, your good health, your youth, all of these things, you know, your good eyesight, all of these things we have for a period of time. They're in our possession. We're the stewards of them for a period of time. Even our house, our apartment, our car, our animals, our mates, our family, everything we have for a period of time. So we're their caretakers, or we're their stewards of everything that we have. But all that we have has come to us, and it will also go. And so, that's a fact. And so if we superimpose some other type of relationship on them, such as ownership, this is mine, and this is really mine only as long as it's with me. Right? So you can have this very strong sense of ownership and mineness, but it's false, really. Because the ownership, you don't have any control over the ownership, so you might as well take it as, you know, something that you're caring for or have in your possession for a period of time. You know, and with that type of relationship, then you're actually able to live without going through a lot of suffering, you know, a suffering of loss. You know. Really, it's the whole, you know, vairagya, a lot of these things are just circle around vairagya. vairagya, that idea of dispassion, even I don't like the word dispassion, really, but yeah, it's how we translate dispassion, but what we mean is objectivity, that you're relating to the world as the world is. You're not asking the world to be something other than what it is. That means you have to have a relationship with the world that is not so clingy. In every place where it's clingy, there's pain. Every place where you want to stop something and freeze it and make someone or something or some situation be in a particular way, because this is how it's supposed to be, you know, this is how I meant it to be, this is why I have these things, is so that they will be. This is all ownership, you know, as though you have control. There comes a time when you're giving over more and more and more of your control to Ishwara, letting Ishwara have the control that Ishwara has. You think you have the control, actually Ishwara has the control. So in that famous verse of the Gita, you know, where Bhagavan Krishna says to Arjuna, you know, you be responsible for your karmas. Be responsible for your actions, and let me be responsible for the fruits of action. I'm the karmapaladatta. I'm the one who gives the fruits of the action. You go ahead and do the action, but know that you're not responsible for the results. And so that's very freeing. If my mind can wrap around that, the reality of that, if I can live that, it's very, very freeing, because I'm not asking the universe to be in a way that it isn't. So this asaktihi is just a general type of non-attachment. Then he gets into a deeper, a different type of sakti. He says, anabhishwangaha putra dhara grahadishu. This abhishwangaha means a very strong attachment, abhishwangaha. Yeah, I'll read Shankara's commentary on this, it's really nice. Unabhishwangaha means a freedom from this type of attachment, the type of attachment you have through putra, toward your child, dara, your mate. Putra means son, dara means like wife. But putra, so take putra as your child, dada as your partner, graha, your home, the adi, etc. What Shankara added for this adi, adi means beginning with, right? This very strong attachment toward your child, your wife, your home, etc. The etc., he said, you know, like your servants, because in India, people do have a lot of servants. They're part of the family, actually. And so there's the servants and the servants' children, the dasa. It's the servant family. So they will take care of the servants are part of their family, actually. And they often send the servant children to school, and they take care of them. So there's also a lot of attachment, too, toward their servants. So Shankara added that in. So here, with this type of a attachment, what he says here, he says this, what we call abhishwangaha, he says abhishwangaha nama. What we call this abhishwangaha, it's a asakti visheshaha, it's a particular type of asakti. Asakti is a strong attachment, but it's a vishesha, it's a particular type of asakti, of attachment. And the example he gives is this. He says, it's when there's no separation between you and your feelings and the other. For instance, he says, just as when one person, when the other is happy or sad, he goes, anyasmin sukini dukini va. When the other person is happy or sad, aham eva suki. I am happy. Only then am I happy, or I am sad. So if you are happy, I am happy. If you are sad, I am sad. Then he gives another example. Jivati mrityava. If you live or die, then ahameva jivami. I can live or I will die. If you live, I can live. If you die, I will die. He says straight out. So he says, this type of kind of extreme attachment, it's like an absolute antyanteshu, anyeshu, antyanteshu, dasa, vargadishu, toward all of these things, the attachment is total, you know, where my well-being, my life is dependent upon you. My emotional well-being is dependent on your emotional well-being. So it's as though you're really giving your whole soul to the person. This is very common in terms of family, mm-hmm. in terms of partner, and in terms of your children. You know, they even talk about that very graphically in these commentaries where the son or the child is looked at upon as myself, as my very self. And that's how that relationship with the child is experienced. And I think that's true all over the world. So the attachment toward child and family is extreme. And then also towards your home, you know, the very thing that gives you all your security and your comfort, that attachment is so much. And so he's saying, you know, what is it to be free of that attachment, to not to have care and love? So there's no possibility of having a family and having your partner and not having care and love, you know. But what about when it crosses to the line to an extreme attachment, to where your very being is dependent upon their being, your happiness is dependent on their happiness? That becomes unhealthy. It's not even healthy for the partner. It's not healthy for anybody. It's not healthy for the child. They're not allowed to grow because your well-being is so dependent upon them. You know, even marriages and partnerships and all this, they don't work when it's like this, because the partner feels strangled. Both will feel strangled. The child can't grow, you know. And but it's a common thing. So you have to have some sort of insight to be able to pull yourself away from it, because it's natural, actually. You know, the care and the love is so much that to let it stay at that care and love, and not bleed over into an attachment where your happiness is dependent on their happiness, you know, or the way that they treat you. That's a tremendous, tremendous burden on all involved. So that's the being free of that type of attachment. Then he says, nityam cha samachittatvam ishta anishta upapattishu. Nityam here just means sada, always. There's a samachittatvam, the state of having a mind which is balanced, which is objective. Samatva means that sameness of mind. So there's a shanti, the sameness of mind. When one gains, upapatti means to gain, to obtain or gain, that which is ishta and that which is anishta. Ishta means those things which are desired. Anishta means those things which are not desired. So, you know, it's punya and papa. Like, if you look at sometimes if we look at the situations that come to you as a jiva when you go through your life from beginning to, and it's kind of 50-50, there's many situations that are desirable to you and you're happy when they occur. And there's many situations that are not desirable and you're unhappy when they occur. That's normal. I like this, I'm happy. I don't like this, I'm unhappy. Right? But for a jnani, that's not quite the orientation. There are things that are desirable and things that are undesirable, but my mind isn't engaged with them in such a way that I become unhappy or elated. Elated or dejected when any given situation occurs. That's the samachittatvam. Why a person say as a mumukshu, you gain that samachittatvam because of that karma yoga buddhi, where your whole orientation really is toward moksha, it's all toward liberation. And so your orientation toward all of your experiences, one as really, I do the action, but I accept the results of any action as Ishwara. So I have that prasada buddhi, means that where I take all the results of actions for as Ishwara. And then just as I receive prasad from the temple, I receive the results of the actions in that way. It means my whole life, my whole relationship to the world really, is a relationship to Ishwara. So everything that comes my way, I take with that prasada buddhi. That's for a mumukshu. As you gain knowledge, as you gain more rooted in your knowledge, then your ananda, the source of your ananda, is not the world. It's not the positive and negative events that are your source of ananda. The source of ananda for the mind is the Atma, is the Self. Because that's where the ananda is. That is the ananda, in fact. For the Ajnani, the ananda is projected on the world, and then, you know, the world has to perform in the way that you ask it to. In order for your mind to become, to be calm, the world has to fulfill your expectations for you to be happy. What's making you happy only is that at this particular moment in time, a desire is being fulfilled, and at that moment, you're desireless. So your mind is like a clear water bucket, you know, reflecting the sun, and you feel happy. The Jnani doesn't relate to the world in that way, really. The sun and the water bucket story, the sun is the Atma, right? And so that your being is the one that is whole and complete, right? So the mind goes straight, enjoys a shanti because it's not searching for wholeness. Why shouldn't it have shanti if the source of the wholeness, of the fullness, is not away from it? For the Ajnani, the source of the fullness has been projected, or the happiness has been projected out onto an object. The object is away from you. There are many things that can go wrong for you receiving, being able to grab onto that projection. You know, many things can go wrong, so the mind enjoys a lot of stress, a lot of upsetness, until you get the object, and then you get the object, and your mind is desireless for a few moments. a few moments of peace and shanti. And because the mind is desireless every time it fulfills a desire. So it's a grand, grand illusion. The Jnani is not, as your mind matures and assimilates this the truth of all of this, the mind revels in the source of the ananda, not in the projected ananda. And if you're reveling in the source of the ananda, then you're free to experience objectively the positive and negative events that the world has to throw your way, which are plenty. You know, it's not like you gain knowledge and then everything becomes good. You gain knowledge and everything is just as difficult as it was before. in terms of the facts of your life, you know, the challenges don't stop, the difficulties don't stop, but the way you are with it does stop, because the situations and the good and the bad situations are not the source of the ananda anyway. You know? And so the mind enjoying the source of the ananda then can objectively handle the positive and the negative events. The positive events are no problem for anybody. But the positive events are always circumscribed by the negative ones. You know. So it's not Swargaloka. There's plenty of challenges. The challenges for us, if they are causing us pain, those challenges are a sadhana. What is it about this situation that is making me so miserable? That just becomes something for me to work on. You know, because in reality, the source of the ananda, nothing has happened to it. Nothing. Nothing has happened to me. Doesn't matter what the situation is. Nothing has happened to your fullness, your wholeness, and your mind. Whatever condition it is in, it's not away from it at all, just like the pot's not away from the clay. And it's not like the world can do any, even Ishwar can't do anything about it. And Ishwar could be having a huge temper tantrum. All creation, nothing touches the Self. The same Self that you are is the Self that Ishwar is. It's not objectifiable. It's not something that you can make miserable. You can't do anything. That you can't change it at all. So your being is free. So your being survives all situations. Even death, it survives everything. It's not subject to time. And so as the mind assimilates the fact of it, you know, more and more it just stays home. It stays home. That I mean that enjoying my the wholeness of myself, I experience the world. And since I'm not asking the world to be any particular way, that allows me to experience the world as Ishwara. As a karma yogi, when I'm gaining this knowledge, I experience the world as Ishwara in that I accept myself as the karta, the doer. Right? This is as karma yogi as I'm gaining knowledge. I accept myself as a doer, but as a karta, but I accept all of the results of my actions as Ishwara, as the karmapala datta, the one who is the giver of the fruits of action. Then that way, again, I'm totally related to Ishwara. I'm accepting this universe, everything that it has to give me, as prasad from the Lord. So even though that kartritva, that doership is there, that ahankara is there, that jiva is alive and well, that jivatvam, still, with that attitude, I'm neutralizing all of the raga dvesha, all of the likes and dislikes, because I'm accepting everything that comes my way as being from Ishwara. I don't take myself as the one who's responsible for all of the fruits of my actions, only for the actions themselves. The fruits of the actions are too complicated. It's way too complicated to think that you can be the author of everything that happens to you. There's just too many pieces to the puzzle, too many things involved in the results of any action that go way beyond you. And so you start having that, what we call that Ishwara Arpana Buddhi, where my buddhi, my knowledge is really, there's a shraddham devotion to Ishwara. So that's how I can have this prasada buddhi that gives so much shanti. As a jnani, as you gain knowledge, the source of ananda is you, your being, the self, which is you, which is Ishwara. The mind recognizes that, you know, and so there's not, it's not about kartritvam or anything, it's just about the mind's, it's not even a resolution of kartritvam. There is a resolution of kartritvam, of doership, because myself is free. But when the wholeness of myself is aparoksha, means it's self-evident, then the mind revels in that. Reveling in that experiences the world as Ishwara. You yourself, as though, even without any knowledge, when your mind is full, happy, and you're not asking anything of the world, at those times in your life, the world isn't divided up. You know, you have a appreciation of Ishwara, really appreciation of the world as it is, because you're not asking anything of it. When you ask something of it, then the whole world divides up into likes and dislikes. I want this thing, these people and situations help me get it, these people and these situations are creating problems for me. There's all duality. There's just it's like the whole world breaks up into duality. Me and the object I desire, and then everybody else who's contributing or not contributing to that happening. When you are free inside, means that those moments when you fulfill the desire, nobody's disturbing it. At those times, it's a whole different universe. It's religious, actually. Like if you're walking in nature, for instance, that's a good example. You know, you realize the beauty of the creation, the beauty of others, the beauty of the world, you realize. Because at that moment, you're not asking it to be different. Well, you don't ask things to be different when you're full. When you're happy, you know, those moments of fullness or happiness, you don't ask anything to be different. The instant you ask something to be different, that fullness starts to go away. Well, you can see then for a jnani, one who has knowledge, when your mind has had the chance to assimilate, even on an emotional level, the source of the ananda is your being. The mind loves to be with ananda. If I think an object has the ananda, I love to be with that object. You know, whatever has wherever the ananda has landed, that's where I want to be. When the mind discovers my being is the source of the ananda, that's where it wants to be. So enjoying that, then it can be with the world and be with others and give others the freedom to be who they are. Also give yourself the freedom to be who you are too. If the mind has that recognition of the ananda that you are, then you can take care of your own little children also. Yep, you know? Even this inner child work we do, to take care of the complexes and hurts and little ones we have inside. When the buddhi, which holds your knowledge really, recognizes your being as the source of that ananda, then the buddhi, which is the one who becomes the inner friend to all the little ones inside, all of the work that has to be done, the complexes, all the hurts inside, that buddhi is enjoying the ananda of me. And enjoying the fullness of myself, that buddhi can give the love and care to the little ones inside, just as it can give love and care to the ones outside, without thinking about it. But the buddhi itself, because of your knowledge, has that source. The buddhi has the source of ananda. And that buddhi then can talk to the little ones in the unconscious and help them to grow and develop. You're not trying to make them into little jnanis. You're trying to make all of those parts inside get the love which they didn't get for a variety of reasons. The love and the care that they didn't get for many, many, many different and complex reasons. You know? And sometimes it's because of abuse. Even if the parents didn't mean to be abusive, they could be abusive. But also the child can be sensitive, and a little child can, and just imagine a little 3-year-old amidst all of these giants. You know? And the way that the parents and the people respond is, or it can be overwhelming, it can be scary. So you have no idea what type of complexities went on to create, little fear pockets, little hurt feelings, all kinds of little scared pockets inside of hurt children, and those all have to be given a safety so that they can grow. But the buddhi, for the buddhi that has knowledge, and you don't have to have knowledge for it, but it's helpful. The buddhi that has knowledge, that buddhi really has that source of ananda with which to hold, all the ones inside and give them a chance to grow, inside and outside. So that's the that samachittatvam can only really come, if sama means nityam, the nityam, it's a samachittatvam, that sameness of mind which is always. It can only always be the same, it can be always the same because the self is always the same. So in terms of its state of well-being, its state of freedom, its state of fullness, it can have that all of the time because that is the nature of the self. If the self is being projected out onto objects that are subject to birth and death and moods, whatnot, then it's not always going to be the same. The mind's going to be in constantly reacting to the world. But when its love affair is with the Atma, then there's no problem because the Atma, the self, never goes away. You can't get rid of it. And it's not moody. It is always whole and complete. So that's nityam cha samachittatvam ishta nishta upapattiṣu. It's the only way you can do it. Otherwise, an unhappy situation is an unhappy situation. If a situation that's meant to cause you pain is taking place, then it will cause you pain if your ananda is superimposed onto the situation. Yeah. So, that being so, let's do this next one.
Mayi chananya yogena bhaktiradhya vicharini bhaktiradhya vicharini vivikta desha sevitvam vivikta desha sevitvam aratir janasam siddhi aratir janasam siddhi mayi cha ananya yogena bhaktihi avyabhicharini vivikta desha sevitvam aratihi janasam siddhi. He says, mayicha
and in me. So he says, after, you know, having this samachittatvam and not having these extreme forms of attachment, having given all of that up, he says, ananya yogena bhaktihi avyabhicharini. He says, mayicha, and in me, ananya yogena bhaktihi, a devotion, a bhakti, which is avyabhicharini. Avyabhicharini means is unwavering. It's not a fly-by-night thing. It's a devotion toward Ishwara, which is avyabhicharini. It's unwavering. And ananya yogena, it's by a mind which is not committed to anything else. Anya means other. Ananya means not to another. So by your mind, which is not attached to anything else. So that devotion is unwavering. It's not like I love you today, but I love, you know, him or her tomorrow. It's that the love or the ananda or the attachment and the commitment is to Ishwara only. It's only to Ishwara. It's not like the world divides up Ishwara and you and you and you. There is love and care and relationship. There's love, care, relationship, commitment, engagement. It's not like this toward the world, but the devotion is toward Ishwara. The commitment really is to Bhagavan. That's wherefore a jnani and a mumukshu, it's not I'm a mumukshu and. As a mumukshu, I'm everything else. But the mumukshu is first. Right? It's not like I'm sometimes in a mumukshu or once in a while I'm a mumukshu. Oh, everything that I am, everything that I do has that as its core, or my knowledge. My knowledge is as my core. The knowledge, if the mumukshu tvam or your knowledge is at your core, and everything is Ishwara for you, then whenever that is not so, that is a sadhana. You know, when I don't see everything as Ishwara, or if I'm away from myself, if that's the feeling, I'm away from myself, or I'm not appreciating Ishwara. And appreciating Ishwara, it's not like I have to walk around appreciating Ishwara. It isn't that. You know, it's that what is natural for you is dharma. The appreciation of Ishwara is dharma. I'm not called outside of dharma, you know? Because if I'm called outside of dharma, then there's the jiva. Why would I be called outside of dharma? You know? What is here given to me to be done, the prarabdha karma, what I'm called to do, that is what I do. I'm not called... If I go outside of that, that's because of raga dvesha, you know? It's like, I want this. Why do you want this? So that I can be happy. So I want this. Bhagavan wants this, means the order that's unfolding. But Bhagavan is just really irritating me right now. Because I want this. So now the jiva is there. But for a jnani, really, for a mumukshu, or as you're working on your own maturity, when you're called outside of dharma, then that's sadhana. You know, it's not that you go outside of dharma, or if you do, you pull yourself back because of sadhana. You see what I mean? So it's not that you're perfect or that you're just so mature, but everything, all of the ways that you're not mature are the things you work on. You see what I mean? That means that there's really nothing else for you. Everything that is not Ishwara, or everything that is not just the manifestation of your knowledge, is your sadhana. And so where is there room for anything else? If there's anything else, then what is that? You know, then that's a time where your knowledge is over here, and now you're over here. And I think that for what makes a person a mumukshu, or even interested in this knowledge in the first place, is that they've already realized to a significant enough degree that this world, this body, this mind, these sense organs, all experiences and all possibilities that the world has to give are not enough. by their very nature, to solve this problem of my own incompleteness. I need to know. I need knowledge. That's the state of a mumukshu. And so then the devotion is to that knowledge, right? Is to the gain of that knowledge. It's just another way of saying is the devotion is to Ishvara. The devotion is to Ishvara, to knowledge of Ishvara, which includes knowledge of myself. And there's just nothing outside of that. And so here, that's where he says the bhakti one has is avyabhichari, chadini. It's single-pointed. It's not something, it's unwavering. It's unwavering. It sounds maybe big when you say that, but it isn't big. It's unwavering because there's no place to waver to. See what I mean? If you have a place to waver to, then there's something in the universe that isn't included in your viveka, in your discrimination. Then you can waver over to that place, but then you're really not a mumukshu. You're not a mumukshu because you still think there's a solution. If I waver over to this place and my bhakti goes there, then there's a solution over there for me. But for a mumukshu, that solution is not there. The solutions are all mithya. You may waver over into this way or this way, but it's all superficial. Superficial wavering. Superficial wavering that you pull yourself back from. You understand what I mean? So that superficial wavering, you know, is really by a mind, a buddhi, that has recognized the problem, and so there's no real place to waver to. So that's that ananya yoga. It's not attached to anything else because you've already recognized, been through that, recognized that there is nothing else that's going to work. That's the viveka vairagya. You know, when we talk about the qualifications of an adhikari, and by qualifications, it's not a big thing. It's like the qualifications, why would you bother to listen to this knowledge? Only certain people listen to it. Only certain people care. That's what we mean by qualification. Those are people who have the viveka and the vairagya that comes from that, and then the mumukshutvam that comes from that. And then those group of six qualifications, shama, dhamma, paritishtikshadi, shraddha, samadhanam, these qualifications are just natural to a mind that has the viveka and the vairagya and the mumukshutvam. Then you find your mind naturally gaining some sort of a different type of shanti. It has a different type of peace than another type of mind would have, because you've already withdrawn some of your libido, you know, from the world, because you're no longer in your heart believing that this world is going to give you what you need. That itself gives you some release from the world, is in that recognition. So this one, the Mayicha Ananya Yogena Bhaktihi Avyabhicharini. Next one is Vivikta Desha Sevitvam. This is interesting. There is a freedom of mind that enjoys, that allows you to enjoy being alone. You don't run away from people. It's not about running away from people, but it's about a happiness and not a need, a happiness being alone and not a need for people. It's different, you know. It's not being like a hermit or, you know, a socially inept person. It's not that. It's that you're fine being alone. There's nothing calling you out, you know, to have to be with other people. So there's a comfort with being alone. There's no pressure. It's freedom from pressure. It's not even saying anything at all about not enjoying people. It's not about that. It's about the freedom or the enjoyment of being in a place which is devoid of people. You know, freedom to be, the freedom to be alone. And then the other one is this aratihi janasamsadhi. Here, this one means not seeking out. Aratihi means not enjoying or seeking out the company of people. And so here, this is different. What they're talking about is not seeking out the company of people who are, as Shankara says, he says something kind of nice here about this. He says, Jananam Prakritanam. He says, Prakrita, the Prakrita people are just kind of the gross people. Prakrita means gross. These gross people. Then he says, the samskara.
Yeah, we don't like them.
uncivilized, you know, kind of gross, uncivilized people. The ones who are not clean. He says, samskara shunyanam. They're devoid of the samskaras. Samskaras means they're not clean. They don't have also the dharma. They're unclean people. And avinitanam, he says, and these fellows at Saswamji, they're proud fellows. They're arrogant fellows. Vinita means humble. Avinita means, you know, proud. So these proud, you know, kind of ordinary fellows, you know, who don't have real dharma or saucham or cleanliness. You don't seek out those kind of people. But he says, on the other hand, you do seek out and want to be in the company of those people who are vinita. They do have some modesty. They do have these samskaras, like the Vedanta samskaras. They're people that you respect, the people that you respect and whose values you want to emulate. So satsang, those kind of people, guru bhais, people who have the same values, you know, who you want to be like, you know, those type of people, they're not talking about. Why? Jnana upakarakatva. Because those type of people lead to knowledge. It means they help you to gain the antakarana shuddhi, the purity of mind, which is really the container for gaining this knowledge. And so all of these, the samanitvam, adambitvam, all of these qualities are really for the seeker, you know, to gain this relative shanti, relative well-being, so that the mind is something that this knowledge can really take place in and take root in. So here, satsang, keeping the company of the good, keeping the company of people who you look up to and respect, who you respect their values, you know, in their heart. Those type of people you stay around. But you're not inclined to go out with your old drinking buddies or, you know, or you know, all the ones who get involved in things that are really not in your best interest. Those, you lose the inclination to be with those kind of people. And you gain an inclination to be with people who have the type of values that you want to live up to, that you yourself want. Okay? So that's good. Let's stop there. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
Purity of mind.
What is meant by purity of mind? Really, what all it really means when they're talking about this antakarana shuddhi, in the end, it means a mind that is available to gain knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so that mind, such a mind requires certain amounts, a certain level of relative shanti. And then these values, the amanitam of other values, are the values which really, an understanding, that's why each one of these values can actually be contemplated upon. You know, because as you own up these values, what causes on a relative level a lot of agitation and a lot of extroversion, I need this, a lot of raga dvesha, those type of extroversions relatively come to kind of abate. You know. But when we're really talking about antakarna shuddhi, it is a mind that enjoys relative shanti, so that it's available for this knowledge. It's important because we have all kinds of big ideas about purity of mind, ideas that are not true. You know, just like ideas about enlightenment, but they're big words.
Well, what are those big ideas about the great purity of mind?
I think, you know, it's like being in an altered state. Your mind is so pure that bliss is pouring out of the seams, or that it's all it's just an altered state rather than just being a normal mind that is peaceful. You don't need an altered state. And yourself, yourself is already whole, complete, free. Yourself is not an altered state. But I think that this antakarna shuddhi and purity of mind gets equated to an altered state rather than to the very simple shanti, you know, where there's that shanti, that peace. And the nature of your being is so real, it is you. It's not an altered state. And so as the mind gets rid of the ajnanam, all of this ignorance that causes so many projections, it just becomes relaxed and enjoys your being unencumbered. Your being already is unencumbered and always exactly the same, and always you. This very most precious thing is the me that you already take yourself to be. What makes it so painful is that the mind has superimposed itself on it, and the body and all these raga dveshas and agitations are all circling around your own being. Right? Because they're wanting, the mind is wanting you, but it's projected you outside. And so it gets into just a tizzy, you know, all kinds of complexities. But when all those complexities relax, then just you as you are, you know, is the mind is enjoying. So the mind isn't competing by producing a lot of pain unnecessarily. It's not competing with your own presence. That's even better than that. You know, because it doesn't really matter what your mind is doing. Because you're there. And it's a huge recognition when you recognize that whatever your thoughts are, your feelings, your emotions are, they are not covering you at all. It's not that they're very pleasant. I mean, you can have unhappy thoughts, but those unhappy thoughts or upset thoughts, it's not as though when those are happening, you are not there. You are as present when the happy thoughts are there as when the negative thoughts are there. And that's the discernment. That's an important discernment. And it's the thing is, that's the most important truth of the whole thing. But the secondary gain is that as your mind recognizes you, the wholeness, the ananda of your being, when it really recognizes that, then it starts losing all of its agitation. Because it doesn't need to go outside or anywhere to get that ananda. Because what makes you so upset is, I need you to be this way. I need the world to be this way. I need a situation to be this way in order for me to be happy. And we have all kinds of investment in that. I'm not saying this is an easy thing. It takes a lot of maturity. Because we have levels and levels of investment around getting my own way. It starts with, I need this to be happy. That's just the very simple I need this to be happy, but then it's, and you are not letting me have this. And so I really hate you. You are ruining my life. And then, why does my mind have all of these problems in the first place? Well, it's the way I was raised, and so I hate my parents. So what I'm saying is that this very complex nest builds up around my initial, I need this. You know, it's not just, that's just the beginning of it. And then I have all the justifications, like if somebody does something wrong to me, wrongs me around my desire, then I need to retaliate. Retaliatory things. And that's why we have all these words. We have words like, you know, retaliation and all of these things, justice. And justice needs to be done and all of these type of things. And
it's got to be fair.
It's got to be fair. All of these. And it's just, it's a complex web that we have to slowly unwind out of all of this, all of the stuff. And it doesn't happen just overnight. Because we're invested in it for lifetimes.
Yeah. On that very note, on one hand, these values can resolve tumult and surface antakarana shuddhi, right? As a sadhana, I have to choose. You know, on one hand, I hear sometimes it takes will to exert these values. They're a sadhana, right? And then that moves us closer to them.
Yeah.
But is that, this is influenced by reading your books and the unconscious, meaning do those values also allow us to resolve these unconscious content, the inner child stuff you talk about? Or do you think that's a separate and distinct practice? Or in these teachings about these values, is there a path to touch those unconscious things that you also talk about? Because I hear you in your writings that you talk that kind of two different solutions are needed. These values alone, we can lead an externally conscious, ethical life, but a lot of internally unresolved stories. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think these values are, some of them are more directed outward, but you can also look at it like this, like the person who is responding externally to the world with ahimsa and straightforwardness and care and all of these type of things is the one who needs to be responding internally. So, for instance, if I have a value like non-injury or care toward others, most of us do have that value, but what we don't understand is that value, we don't know about turning inward. And so the values you have for treating people externally need to be the same values you have for treating the little ones internally. So the values you would have developed for treating a little child, how to be with a child, or say you have a child, how to be with your child, you have to be able to be that way toward the little ones inside. So I think that's what, as we develop a way to be outside based upon our values and our understanding and our relationship to the self and all of that, but sometimes we don't know how to turn that internally. Are you as kind to yourself into the parts inside as you have a value for being outside? And I think actually it's easier to be kind to yourself because you're the one who's being hurt. So yeah, you know.
What, and, could you say that again?
Well, sometimes if you're, when you take something out on another person or you're abusing another person, you can feel there's complexities. You can feel justified and they deserve it and this kind of stuff that allows you to get away with very, very abusive behavior. But if you're doing that toward yourself, you not only are you being abusive to yourself, you are experiencing the abuse. The abuser and the abused are being experienced internally, you know. And if you say you learn how to not do that internally, you also immediately reap the rewards. Mm-hmm. Immediately, the instant you are kind to yourself, there's a response. Just like the instant you're kind to somebody else, there's a response. It changes, the dynamic changes. Not that the dynamic becomes perfect, but the dynamic changes. And I don't. I think if you realize that internally, also it then helps you to be able to be that way externally also. I like the starting internally first, if you can, because it relieves the pressure so much that you have a support system inside that can give you the strength to be kind externally.
Don't many people have even more trouble to do that for themselves?
Well, I think it has to be taught. You have to teach it, and you have to do meditations around it and teach people to do it because they don't know, they don't even know about it. So they do have trouble doing it, they don't even know to do it. It's not even having trouble doing it, it's just simply not even knowing that they're not doing it.
Yeah, nobody taught me that.
No, and you grow up with whatever hurts are there. You know, that's the environment. From childhood, you grow up with these inner voices that are what they are. You don't even think of them as inner voices or that you're mistreating yourself.
So it's like the inner enemy is inflated. The inner friend is like stuck, developmentally stuck. And most people are in a certain way. You can say that, huh?
Yeah.
I think there's something foreign about having one voice inside you talking to another voice too for a while, for some, you know, this idea that who's this me talking to me thing?
Yeah.
What do you mean I should be kind to myself?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's where does that land? How to, you know, so that feels a little, something has to happen to sort of open up that inner dialogue that
it does.
Kind of weird at first, I think.
It is, yeah. It's weird and unknown. Mm-hmm. But once you start doing it, then you realize, like, all of the unconscious hears you, and it responds to you, you know. The buddhi, the conscious mind, can talk to the unconscious or address it, and it will respond.
And it's not a disassociation or this, you know, no. Psychotic state.
right, yeah. Yeah, it's not that. But
that's what people sort of wonder, you know.
And unless they're taught, and when they're taught, I teach all of this to so many students coming through school at CIS, all of my clients, everybody. And once some people do it, then they realize what it is. It's an amazing thing. It changes everything. It changes the whole inner environment. You know, otherwise, the unconscious is just frozen in time. And all it can do is project out. That's what it does. It overwhelms the ego, it overwhelms the conscious mind, and so then you think that's you. And it also projects out onto the world. So say if you look at the characters in the unconscious more as dyads. Like there's the abusive father and the abused son, for instance. Same can do it feminine too, the abusive father or abusive mother and the hurt child. Right? So then what's going to happen is in your experience, sometimes you're going to be that very abusive father, and sometimes you'll be you'll be an abusive father, and your partner or friend or whoever will be the abused child, and you'll treat them just like you were treated. But sometimes they will become the abusive parent, and you will be the hurt child. So you'll be swinging back and forth. From the abuser to the abused. And sometimes you're the abuser, and sometimes you're the abused. But when you're the abused, then the other person is the abuser. Because you're projecting out this dyad. That's what happens.
And this,
you know?
That's so interesting.
This, mm-hmm. This unconscious doesn't grow or go away by itself.
It doesn't change at all unless we do this work where you come into dialogue with it, and then you can transform it as you become consciousness transforms it. Consciousness of it coming into relationship transforms it. Otherwise, it will endlessly just act out. You know, because it's unconscious. You know, what's going to stop it from just acting out as it has been introjected? What stops it is consciousness coming into relationship with it, and that does transform it and change it.
What does introject mean?
Introject means it's a psychology term that when, say, especially when you're a child, like your first 4 to 5 years especially, the way that your parents treat you becomes swallowed whole in a way. Mm-hmm. To that, like, what's swallowed is you and that dyad, the parent and the child, is introject, that relationship, that attitudinal relationship, that way of talking, is swallowed inside into the unconscious. And then what happens is that the way you treat yourself as you grow up will be that way. The way you talk to yourself, the attitude you have toward yourself, and the attitude you have toward others. Because that's the model that's being held inside. It's called object relations, you know. So that's the relationship you have inside, and that's the one you continually live out.
It's sort of like the way that children imitate.
Yes.
But it's so instantaneous and unthinking and unconscious.
Totally.
But it applies across the board.
Across the board.
Physical, in gestures, mannerisms, everything.
Attitudes, emotions, ways of treating people.
Yeah. But same to what you said about the seeking, which community do we seek? I think as adults we do that too. We behave like, you know, the mob, and so that seeking, we moving towards people who will expose us to different ways of being that we might not have had.
That's true. Know,
that's
yeah.
another. That's what I hear in that teaching that we were just talking
yeah.
about. You know, is keeping how to the resolve this is seek those people.
Exactly. That's one thing. Yeah, keeping the company of the satsang means company of the good. People who have the Dharma and values, and what people who are like what you want to be like. You don't want to hang out with people who have all of your weakest tendencies. You know? Support those. You know? We have all, because of these introjects, you know, it's really interesting. Swamiji said this in such an interesting way once. We do have all of these values in most of us. We have the values, and we admire those values in others, and we expect these values in others. Ahimsa, you know, to be respected and to be cared for, so that we want from other people, and we respect those values in other people, and we don't respect the absence of them. You know, so it's not that we don't have the values, but the thing is, we want them from others, but we don't give the same seriousness to our having those values because of pressure.
Well, it's scary to see the absence in yourself. I mean, then you, whoa, what can I do about that?
But you know what? If you see the absence in yourself, that's really good. It's when you don't see the absence. Because what happens is a kind of self-righteous, you know, screw them. Or you would never accept that coming toward you at all. And you would not like that person who's behaving that way. You'd be very critical, probably. And it's just not the appropriate way to behave. But you can get away with it because you'll write it off. You know, so that's just something to be really, really kind of alert to. You know that do unto others as you had done the golden rule? We know it so well coming toward us. But to have, you know, the shama and dhamma, you know, the shama and dhamma means that dhamma is the, shama is where if values or ways of behavior, types of thoughts pass through your mind, you have complete freedom to just let them keep going. You don't, there's, you know, that's shama. Oh, this thought is just some silly thought. You don't have any attachment to it. You just let it pass through. Dhamma comes when these thoughts don't pass through, but they grab you, or emotions grab you.
Yeah.
Dhamma is the ability to not act out on that emotion, you know. But Dhamma fails much more frequently than you might think. Dhamma fails, and you can actually be unconscious of it failing, because your mind will justify, it all happens very quickly, your mind will justify the mean behavior or the nasty behavior. You feel self-righteous.
They deserve it.
It happens so fast that it requires some kind of commitment you know, to watch out for that and to work on yourself in that way. That's what we mean by sadhana. Sadhana isn't just requires consciousness. Change requires consciousness. Yeah. The changes that we're talking about are also natural with knowledge. A lot of it just comes naturally with knowledge because you're taking the pressure off. Knowledge takes the pressure off because of the ananda that was projected out is now recognized as your own being. So a lot of pressure is removed that allows that kind of consciousness, you know, to correct your behavior, not in some sort of mean way, mean toward yourself. It's just that you have the freedom, you have the space to correct behavior that causes pain to you and others.
Could you say that the identifying with the buddhi is a way of stepping outside of the introjected dyads, and it's a way of becoming conscious by no longer participating in the dyad, in a sense.
Or acting
as an adult, I mean a kind adult.
Yeah, well see, once you're conscious of the dyad, then you can come into relationship with it, you know? And once you're conscious of the dyad, sometimes, you know, I'm the hurt child and sometimes I'm the abusive parent. You see both. We even see that. We talk about it. Haven't you ever said, sometimes I'm just like my mother or I'm just like my father? I can't believe it. You know? But once you start...
All the things I swore I'd never do.
Exactly, all of that. So we see all of that, you know.
Or better yet, you tell the other guy, you're just like your mother.
Yeah, yeah. But it's true, once you become conscious of it, then you can actually do inner child work and come into relationship with it and bring about change. You know,
when you do this, brings up a question about inner child work that sometimes uh-huh. comes up for me. That, like, it's really easy, I find personally, to be kind and relate to the abused one. But the one who's being more abusive, I want to shut them down and stop the fight. I mean, I feel like a referee because sometimes, you know, I'm aware that there are these battles going on. And I want to stop the abuse, and that means shutting up the abuser.
Sometimes you can, the shutting up the abuser, one way of thinking of it.
I wonder if there's should it be kinder or what?
Yeah, there's a way of understanding it that I think is really helpful. And that is this, when a child introjects the abuser abused, you know, the mean father, for instance, or the mean mother, say a little three-year-old child is interjecting the mean mother. Well, that's a little three-year-old buddhi, you know, interjecting this mother. So it's like a little girl wearing mommy's shoes, or a boy dressed up like dad, you know, and then acting like it. So you can actually talk to the little one who's playing the part of the big mean father and say, you know, you don't have to do this anymore. It's okay. You did this to protect me. Actually, children will interject. There's different reasons, but one reason is anticipatory anxiety. You know, you're so afraid of that mean father, and you get so anxious that you'll just interject him and have the problem right there taking place now, which is a relief. At least you're getting over it. You know, and so the defense system is playing a role to protect you. You know, and so you can treat the mean one as a part of yourself and tell that part of yourself that you don't need to play this role anymore. It's okay. This is how it was then. This is how your dad was or your mom was when you were little. You know. But they're not like that anymore. You're with me now. And they're old.
but you really mean that the person who is dealing with the inner child need to be actually talking to that inner child?
Yeah.
Not you as a therapist. Because
tell me again.
Well, I'm just saying, if there's a recognition of an interjection
Introjection.
Introjection?
Uh-huh.
Intro. Yeah, introjection.
Yeah.
Of certain of my father, let's say.
Yeah.
Then and me as an inner child, or me as Hasso, has basically taken on a certain response towards that father, right? Then I need to kind of, and me, I'm still reacting like my inner child, which maybe says, has whatever reaction to that father, right?
Uh-huh.
Then I need to communicate with my inner child, with that little boy who experienced it when he was 4 years old, right?
Yeah.
So you mean basically I need to communicate, that connection need to be opened up.
You, the adult Hasso,
yes,
who has knowledge and wisdom at this point, to whatever,
yes,
degree you do,
right,
that adult Hasso has to talk to the little boy Hasso.
Right.
And also, you can get in touch, if you get in touch with the dyad, you can get in touch with the mean father.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like you can, when you're acting mean, in the, you can say,
yeah,
this is, you can recognize, this is my father or this is my mother. And then you can come in relationship with that part.
Yes.
And remember that you interjected that part when you were little.
So that means I need to build a relationship to that. So that's really, whether I do that in therapy or I do that on my own,
yeah,
I need to do it.
Yeah, you need to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the point, right?
That's the point. And I actually think everybody should do it. Everybody needs to do it.
Yeah.
Everybody needs to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that there's a lot of exceptions out there, because I don't think that we have some idyllic childhood or idyllic society where we're growing up without hurts.
So nobody's innocent of these dynamics?
I don't think so. Mm-mm. It's just that we usually don't know how to deal with it. And a lot of times, Bhagawan has given us some things, like, for instance, if you have a family and you have your own children and a certain level of consciousness, you will naturally give to your child the things that you didn't get, mm-hmm, and try to make up for your own limited childhood by the way you treat your child, and that is also very healing. A person who is really too abused will take the abuse out on their child.
Mm-hmm.
The way they were treated, they do the same thing to their child. But many, many people weren't abused to that degree. And so then they give the child. And you find, even if you don't have children, you give to others. You give to others what you didn't get. And that's very healing. And I think Bhagawan, that's one of Bhagawan's very natural tools for healing.
Is there a term for that psychologically?
I don't know.
Anyway.
There may be a term for it. I can't think of a term right now.
It's totally true. I totally experienced that with Mira.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
And you probably experience, of course, if you have a child, I think it's very natural, but
yeah,
you can experience it even if you don't have a child, in the way that you treat others, trying to make up for what you didn't get.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want others to experience that, what happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
So
this
I remember working as a nurse in a hospital, in the nursery, with the tiny babies.
Yeah.
And of course, I was given away as a baby, and I didn't get whatever a baby gets or needs.
Yeah.
And I remember being able to keep 6 babies quiet.
Yeah.
And I hold them and do it, you know, what you do with babies. But that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah,
mm-hmm,
yeah, it's like holding yourself.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful.
And still, I still am very good with babies.
Yeah. Yeah. So sweet, really. That's just a beautiful thing that's natural in the creation.
Oh, you're giving back to your own self, then.
Well, I guess that's what she's explaining, yeah.
It's very healing if you're not doing it consciously, but it's borderline conscious, I think.
But it's interesting, like what you're describing, how it flips when there's a certain kind of intensity of abuse. Then something gets, as if that door gets closed or so, that they
anger,
consider that as a healing possibility?
No, it can become a healing possibility for anyone. You have to work, sometimes you have to work on it because your anger and rage is so much that it overwhelms and then you just take it out on the other. Yeah, that's what happens.
Do you
when you work on yourself, if somebody is working on themselves, then you know you can get over that.
Do you see this inner child work in the teaching methods of Vedanta, or how do they approach it?
I don't think it is so much in the teaching methods, though. I do have stuff to say about that, but I'm too tired right now. We have to stop.
Well, it's kind of a long...
A lot of my questions have been answered like that.
No, no, it's a good question, but I have too much to say.
That's kind of where I was similar.
Right, I want to say something about this, because I think this is one of the most beautiful things that you have to share.
Okay.
And that is, you know, as I'm moving back to Portland, what I'm realizing is that it's coming back around to something so incredibly simple, which is to finally love yourself. And that's exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. All these little things, you know, and as time went, you know, I started to hear myself criticize, you know, things, little things I did, like I needed to be different, you know, and this is what I learned here, is like, all these things were okay. I don't need to change any of them. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's Vedanta, and because of her training, she's able to just really get specific.